produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Daily Audio Stash is where responsible marijuana smokers listen in on the latest news about cannabis, hear the voices of the marijuana law reform movement in special segments and interviews, and kick back with comedy and music no other podcast can offer. It's Normal's Daily Audio Stash. More information at normalaudiostash.com. First up today, it's news from Normal. Our news today, North Carolina governor signs bill to study industrial hemp manufacturing. State officials will assess the economic and environmental feasibility of industrial hemp production, following the recent approval of legislation granting funding for the study of the agricultural crop. The Beneficial Uses of Industrial Hemp Act was passed as part of the Studies Act of 2006 and may potentially lay the groundwork for industrial hemp farming in North Carolina. As passed by the legislature, the act creates, quote, an independent commission to study the beneficial industrial uses of industrial hemp, including the use of industrial hemp oil as an alternative fuel and the use of industrial hemp fiber in construction and paper products, to study the economic opportunities industrial hemp provides the state, and to consider the desirability and feasibility of authorizing industrial hemp cultivation and production as a farm product in North Carolina, close quote. The commission will be comprised of 15 members, including delegates of the governor, the commissioner of agriculture, the secretary of commerce, as well as House and Senate leaders, among others. The commission will report its findings and recommendations to the 2007 General Assembly and the Environmental Review Commission by December 1, 2006. Previous state-sponsored studies of the crop have estimated that hemp cultivation could yield farmers between $320 to $600 per acre. A review of these state-sponsored hemp studies is available online at normal.org. We have links at normalaudiostash.com.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than 500,000 Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Dr. John P. Morgan, a physician and professor emeritus of pharmacology at City University of New York. Dr. Morgan serves on Normal's advisory board and is co-author of the book, Marijuana Myths, Marijuana Facts. Dr. Morgan, welcome back to Normal's Daily Audio Stash today.
Thanks, Chris. I'm happy to be back.
Great to speak with you again, John. We've been covering the release of the new Normal report, Emerging Clinical Applications for Cannabis and Cannabinoids, posted up at normal.org. First, what is some of the research that has come out in the last few years and highlighted in this report that really piqued your interest?
Paul is doing such valuable work for all of us that he's really a treasure. I'm intrigued by this issue of the poorly understood phenomenon of antioxidation. If you'll notice in a couple of the issues, prevention of neural damage, the hopes of the following strokes, the use in some GI conditions and diabetes, that people talk too much about the phenomenon of antioxidants. And, you know, of course, if you go to your health food store, someone behind the counter will explain to you very carefully, while making no sense at all, how you need to take vitamin E and other antioxidants. Now, what's quite clear is that THC, or more likely its precursor, CBD, operates in biological tissue as an antioxidant. And let me give you just a minute or two about what that might mean. The human system, the animal system as well, diminishes the toxicity of a number of biologically active compounds by oxidating them. You know, we oxidate THC, we oxidate morphine, we oxidate quinidine and penicillin, and that's one of the ways, usually in the liver, that's one of the ways that we diminish the activity of compounds. Now, people for many years have been interested in antioxidants because it's clear that the aging and deterioration process in some diseases is related to oxidation of biological compounds that we make ourselves. So at this moment, particularly in terms of the neuroprotective mechanism, the ability of cannabinoids to diminish tumor growth or tumor cell growth in some systems, I find just as intriguing as can be, and hope that indeed some of that research will pay off.
And some of the research mentioned the antioxidant factor was relating to the Alzheimer's condition, where the incredible antioxidant properties of CBD essentially washed away the buildup of amyloid plaque in rat brain culture. How is this working?
I have to assume that if the animal model has anything to do with the human disease, and one cannot assume that, as I'm sure you know, that sometimes we have an animal model and it pays off well, and other times it turns out to not lead us anywhere, except maybe lead us down the wrong road. Now, it seems almost certain that human pre-senile dementia is related to the generation of this amyloid and amyloid plaques in the brain. And in this animal model research, the use of CBD, cannabidiol, which I'll say something more about because it's such an interesting compound, interferes with the generation of the amyloid in the animal model. Also, there was a later study which showed that THC itself might interfere with the metabolic requirement in tissue to make amyloid. So there are a couple of hopeful hints, hopeful signals that the drug might be of value through its antioxidant properties in this dreadful condition in Alzheimer's disease. May I say a word about CBD, Chris?
Oh, definitely. Yes, please.
Many people don't realize that the cannabis sativa plant synthesizes cannabinoids in a sort of train, and that CBD is the immediate precursor of delta-9 THC. Now, it has none of the effects that THC does because it doesn't bind to the CB1 receptor. It's very similar chemically, but it does not bind, and in fact, in most studies early on, it's not shown to have any activity. And there has been much speculation about the necessity of CBD for marijuana's therapeutic effect and its anti-seizure effect, and its pain-relieving effect, et cetera, et cetera. People think that there has to be CBD in the plant. Now, I don't think there's adequate proof of that. And in fact, I have communicated with a couple of quite well-known cannabinoid scientists, asking them if I can continue to get away with saying, as far as I can tell, all of marijuana's effects may be reproduced by proper dosage with pure delta-9 THC. Now, Paul Armentero, who wrote this report that you and I are talking about, is very, very intrigued with the activity of CBD in some human cancer cell cultures, the activity of CBD you just mentioned in Alzheimer's disease. But I point out to you that most marijuana that humans consume has an unknown concentration of CBD. It may be high, it may be low, it may be absent, depending upon the activity of the plant and how long it's been making CBD into THC. So we're at a real difficult point in life. You know, Paul and I have arguments about the fact that he thinks that the ingestion of marijuana may have an anti-cancer effect, but there is, in truth, no proof of that whatsoever. I hope, of course, that research with CBD continues, but people should not get so overwhelmingly enthusiastic about multi-cannabinoid preparations. And the truth is, we don't know what's in most marijuana that humans consume, except most of it has delta-9 THC. Otherwise, it will have none of the marijuana effects that we know.
So the THC level is easy to find out for smoked cannabis because of the intoxicating effect. But Dr. Morgan, a lot of patients relate this strong anecdotal evidence that certain strains of cannabis have positive effects, say, on MS mobility, incontinence, or pain. And this hints that the different compounds of cannabinoids in marijuana are having some different effects. So how do we tell? How do we test a plant to find out what's in it?
I was once involved in the analysis of some marijuana that people in California were absolutely sure this particular plant was valuable in multiple sclerosis, other neuropathic conditions, valuable in seizure disorders. And the people were convinced, very goodwill, that this was high CBD marijuana. And they thought they had understood the growth and the strains, and they had taken material from other previous high CBD marijuana. And they were all convinced if they had this material, it was good. If they had other marijuana, it was no good. Now, we actually had some of that material analyzed. I won't quote it in great detail, but most of the material that I sent onto the laboratory had no CBD in it whatsoever. So our dilemma here is, of course, we have to trust to some degree what people tell us, what they believe. They say, this marijuana is good, that marijuana is not good, this hashish that I've eaten is good, that is not good, because that's really the only way that information progresses. But you must not rely upon those as definitive, because humans are able to fool themselves and make commitments to the appearance. You know, there is a study done in humans a long time ago in which people were given various placebos, and it was always true that red placebos were better than blue placebos. People said, oh, no, that red pill is much better, and it did blah, blah, blah. Because, you know, our brains are good for certain things, and also they're bad for certain things. And being discriminant and being absolutely convinced that this particular form, this particular color, this particular smell, this particular purple hairy plant is the one I absolutely need must be confirmed by careful study and analysis of the product. You know, again, there is a value here. I hope I'm not running on too long. There's a value here which is sort of akin to the herbalist value. You know, many of our friends in the medical marijuana movement are herbalists. That is, they believe that there's still much valuable therapeutic potential to be found in plants of the earth. You know, we found some very good drugs in plants of the earth. But the herbalist value tends to extend to there are many different chemicals in the plant, and they all must be good. We need multi-cannabinoid marijuana because all of those other chemicals in there must do something, and the mixed must be what God and nature and power of botany require. But the truth is that may not be true. It doesn't matter very much what opium we use. It matters how much morphine is in the opium, how much morphine we take. Even
this
though there are five or six other chemicals in opium as well.
This is fascinating, Dr. Morgan. When we talk about this, how accessible would it be for medical marijuana patients to actually test different strains to see what different levels of cannabinoids they contain?
Part of our dilemma is that the measurement of the different cannabinoid content of plants is difficult. Almost all of the measurement in the United States has been done by one laboratory at the University of Mississippi, and I think they're very trustworthy. So if you or I were to call up the University of Mississippi tomorrow and say, listen, I have this marijuana, which I'm sure is blah, 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 would you analyze it for me? And he will charge you $150 per analysis, which is probably more than it costs him, but that's okay. He's allowed to make a buck. So our dilemma is we have very few studies in which a particular effect of the plant is confirmed, usually by doing a trial, and then the plant is analyzed so we can see the cannabinoid mix. In reality, I said we have very few studies. We have none. I know of none. I only know of speculation and belief. And let me tell you another problem. Let's say that you came to me and said, there are a group of patients with inflammatory disease of the bowel, and I am absolutely convinced that smoking this particular marijuana, we'll keep it smoking for a moment, smoking this particular marijuana is therapeutic. And so then I, as a trained clinical pharmacologist, say, well, we've got to do a double-blind controlled clinical trial. We're in trouble right away because experienced marijuana users can't be fooled. You can't give them placebo marijuana and have them not know. 97% of experienced users will pick out marijuana from decannabinized marijuana, from marijuana that has the THC taken out. They can tell. So right away, we're in trouble with double-blind clinical trials. But let's say we go ahead and do it, and then we decide, well, I think this plant is a little bit better. But there we are. What are we going to do about analyzing the plant for its cannabinoid content? As I said, I did some reading in the old opium literature, and the literature has in it just the same kind of speculations that you hear from the cannabis literature, in which people said, oh, opium from Morocco is so much different and better than opium from the New World or opium from China or opium from India or opium from wherever. And in reality, none of those speculations were true. The question of opium is how much morphine is in it. There is some codeine in it, which occasionally could matter, but by and large it's not. It's the morphine. But yet the speculation, the romance, the black Afghani versus the the material from India led people to make wild speculation, which I believe at this moment are all rejectable about opium. They may not be rejectable about cannabis. I do not know, but I also know that much romanticism, I stand up in front of people and say to them, I don't think there's much proof that that there have been enormous claims, enormous increases in potency in current marijuana. And so there are two people in the audience who argue with me, the feds and the heads. The feds believe that the ONDCP and the DEA believe the current marijuana is so dreadfully potent that it's so dangerous. And regular users who say to me, I haven't bought anything but buds for years, man, they tell me that the new marijuana is so dreadfully more potent too. And there isn't much proof, but belief is overwhelmingly incomplete.
And John, how much of that is a cultural thing? You know, American marijuana smokers really have become connoisseurs. When you say folks buy buds now, you know, 30 years ago, the marijuana being sold wasn't as manicured. There was much more leaf and stems and the different flora and fauna of the surrounding woods where it was grown in there.
I smoked marijuana in 1961, and it seemed to me I sucked on that cigarette until my cheeks collapsed. And Lord knows if there was any THC in there at all, because I was in Cincinnati, Ohio, and Ohio and Kentucky was a place where there was wild marijuana growing from hemp seed and from hemp plantings. And as people will tell you correctly, hemp planting seed had very little THC generating capacity. And so, again, over a period of time with more growth and more farming in the United States, people have become convinced that current marijuana is not just a little bit better, which I think is true, but much, much better. Any time that people are allowed to grow, and particularly if they're not hassled, I think the THC content will go up. Let's say if you're a farmer and you don't have to worry about hiding it from the feds and the police, and et cetera, and you grow a crop, and then you smoke it, and you say, God, this is really good. And your friends will say, God, this is really good. That's where you get your seeds for the next crop. And so farming becomes an important mechanism of natural selection. And the THC content of the plant, I believe, is determined by almost completely by the genetics of the plant. I know that farming techniques have some impact, but they're much less important than people think.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash today, and we're speaking with Dr. John P. Morgan. And Dr. Morgan, getting back to the report, Emerging Clinical Applications for Cannabis and Cannabinoids. So many of these deal with isolated cannabinoids injected right into the cells being studied. Again, this must require finding those cannabinoids.
At times when they've needed some marijuana mailed to a laboratory, have used me because I had a license, which enabled me to receive and mail on illegal material. But routinely you cannot do that. And of course, this is one of the reasons why cannabinoid research has lagged behind so dreadfully in the United States, is the federal law preventing mailing of material, federal law preventing possession and growth of material. In the 1970s, there were two books published about potential medicinal uses of marijuana. They're both quite good books, and they were, in essence, sponsored by the federal government, and the books were edited by federal government employees who were all in favor of looking for therapeutic applications of cannabis. In 1980, in the Reagan administration, the official decision was forced out of the throats of NIDA speakers to say, well, of course, marijuana is much too dangerous, and so the only thing we can do is pay some attention to cannabinoid or congener research. And basically, as Paul said in this text, if not others, most marijuana research stopped in the United States. And certainly therapeutic research stopped, and if it hadn't been for Bob Randall in his lawsuit in 1976, in which a federal judge then forced the federal government to supply cannabis to glaucoma patients, things would have absolutely come to a halt. And there are other things that have mattered. And we're now to the point where some research can be done, but the kind of sophisticated research that we're talking about, let's say you look at an animal study and you see that an injection of pure Delta-9 THC or pure CBD into a particular area of a brain works, then what you'd like to do is to have some material either for ingestion, eating, smoking, putting under the tongue, as one will do with Sativex. You'd like to have material that you know exactly its content. We don't do much research with crude opium anymore, and we don't do pain research with willow bark, although it contains significant amounts of acetyl salicylic acid. Now, please don't misunderstand me. My belief is that we need, indeed, much sophisticated cannabinoid research, but, of course, I believe that people should have the right to smoke any marijuana they grow or find or buy or trip along beside the roadside. I think the whole issue of legalization is appropriately discussed, and it impacts both fields that we're talking about, the decision of humans to use it recreationally, to use that word, and the decision of people to do careful cannabinoid research. Both of those are impaired and ruined by our current legislative view.
So, Dr. Morgan, broad legalization of marijuana really is the only answer, the only way to jumpstart this kind of research and get medicines developed for humans here.
The drug industry, which does not, they're too frightened to talk about it, people say things like, well, the drug industry won't do research with natural marijuana because they won't be able to patent it. That's incorrect. They will be able to patent it the same way that Sativex has patented this under-the-tongue mix of THC and CBD. And the drug industry will sure enough find ways to patent natural product. And if they were freed and we were freed to do more research and we were to relax things, I believe that cannabinoid research is going to pay off. That is the use of Ramonabant, the use of Nabilone. All of those things need to be encouraged to manipulate the molecule and maybe find something that happens to work better in some condition. But in addition, people... the drug industry can do cannabinoid research. The drug industry should be able to do natural plant research and extract of natural plant research without the kind of constraints that's imposed on it.
John, this has been just a wonderful discussion today, and I really want to thank you again for joining us to discuss this new normal report.
Thanks a lot, Chris. I'll talk to you soon.
Dr. John P. Morgan is a physician and professor emeritus of pharmacology at City University of New York. Dr. Morgan serves on Normal's advisory board and is co-author of the book, Marijuana Myths, Marijuana Facts. We have links to the book at normalaudiostash.com.
76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Strop, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Thanks to Podshow.com for all the great pod-safe music. We feature the band Carne Cruda as our theme. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. thanks to Red Aphid Interactive Media for the podcasting technology. We're back at 4:20 tomorrow. If you listen to the Audio Stash, cast your vote at Podcast Alley or other podcast directory services. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. The podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.